customers, though, found it overly exhilarating to the bowels. Business withered away, and they made no money, for after they had poured off what they required for their own needs, the remainder of the liquor was only enough to trade for the next batch of makings. Stavrod had stayed until the poor economy of the venture and the cold weather of November drove him off the mountain. When he finished, Ruby told her part, what she had done during those months while he was gone. She foraged for wild food, grubbed for roots, caught fish in traps she twisted together out of willow boughs, took birds in snares of similar make. She ate whatever birds she caught with little discrimination other than to avoid fish-eaters when possible and carrion-eaters always. Learned only by trial and error what of their internalments were to be eaten and what not. One memorable week she had been luckless in her trapping and ate only chestnuts and hickory nuts ground into meal and baked to a crumbly pone on a piece of fireside slate. One day, out gathering nuts, Ruby had come upon the still. Stavrod was sleeping under a lean-to, and his partner said, "He just lays up in bed all day. Only thing that tells you he's not dead is now and then he works his toes." She'd have gladly, at that moment, and at several since, swapped her lot with any wolf-child. In Ruby's opinion, Romulus and Remus, the Data had read her about, were lucky boys, for they at least had a fierce guardian. Despite such hard and lonesome times, though, Ruby did, in fairness, have this to say for Stavrod. He had never laid a hand to her in anger. She could not remember ever being struck. Then again, he had never even patted her head or put his hand to her cheek in a moment of kindness. She looked at Ada and said, "There, square that with your notion of duty." Before Ada could formulate a complete thought, or even just say, "Oh my," Ruby rose and stalked off into the darkness. Stavrod said nothing, and Pankle said softly, as if to himself, "She's got her drawers in a wad now." Sometime later, having sent Stavrod and Pangle away with only vague hopes of compromise, Ada walked up the path to the outhouse. The night was turning much colder, and she guessed there would be frost by dawn. The moon, full and high, threw such light that every tree limb cast a blue shadow. Had Ada wished, she could have pulled Adam Bede from her pocket and opened it to the moon in red. Only the brightest stars shone out against the gray sky. Surveying them, Ada noted Orion climbing in the east, and then she saw that the moon was missing a part. A thin scoop was cut from out it. Eclipse was what it was. She went back in the house and got three quilts and Monroe's spyglass. It was Italian and pretty to look at, with much scroll work cut into the brass, though not so fine in its optics as those the Germans made. She went to the shed and got a campaign chair, wondering, as she drew one from the stack of four, if it was the chair in which Monroe had died. She unfolded it in the front yard and wrapped up close in the quilts, and stretched out with her face tipped up to the heavens. She looked through the glass, twisting it into focus. The moon snapped sharp in her eye, the shattered edge copper but still clearly visible, one crater at the top with a mountain at its center. Ada watched the progress of the shadow as it marched across the bright face, and even when the eclipse was complete, the moon was still slightly visible, the color of an old scent brownie, and to all appearances just about that big. With the moon all but gone, the Milky Way shone out, a river of light across the sky, a band like blown road dust. Ada ran the glass across it and stopped and peered into the deep of it. Through the glass the stars multiplied into tangled thickets of light and seemed to go on and on until she began to feel that she lay poised and exposed at the edge of a gorge, as if she were looking down, not up, hanging at the bottom limb of her planet's radius. For a moment she spun into the kind of vertigo she had felt at Esco's well lip, as if she might become unstuck and fall helpless into those thorns of light. She opened her other eye and put aside the spyglass. The dark walls of Black Cove rose up and held her fixed in a cup of land, and she lay content and watched the sky as the moon gradually emerged from the earth's shadow. She thought about the refrain of a tune Stavrod had sung that night, a ragged love song. Its ultimate line was, "Come back to me is my request." Stavrod could not have uttered it with more conviction had it been one of the profounder lines of Endymion. Ada had to admit that, at least now and again, just saying what your heart felt, straight and simple and unguarded, could be more useful than 4,000 lines of John Keats. She had never been able to do it in her whole life, but she thought she would like to learn how. She went in the house and got her lap desk and a candle lantern and came back to the chair. She inked her pen and then sat and stared at the paper until her nib dried out. Every phrase she thought of seemed nothing but pose and irony. She wiped the pen clean on a blotter and dipped again and wrote, "Come back to me is my request." She signed her name and folded the paper and addressed it to the hospital in the capital. She wrapped up tight in the quilts, and soon she was asleep, and frost fell on her, and the outer quilt became crisp with rime. A Vow to Bear. Inman walked through mountain country and kept to trails and saw few people. He measured out distance in portions of a day, a full day's walk, half a day, less than half a day. Anything shorter than that was just a little piece down the road. Miles and hours became concepts he disdained, since he had not the means to measure either. He was held back in his travels after he came upon a little-sized woman sitting humped up on a fence rail, crying for her dead girl. The woman's bonnet hood shaded her face, so all Inman could see was black but the tip of her nose. When she turned her face up to Inman, though, the tears dripping from her jawbones sparkled in the morning light. She held her mouth slitted open in anguish, so that in Inman's mind it resembled a sputtering to a sword scabbard. The sun was not up good yet, and she was about to have to bury her child wound up in an old quilt, for she had no idea how to make a box. Inman offered his help and spent the day in her backyard, knocking together a little casket from boards pulled off an ancient curing house. They smelled of hog fat and hickory smoke, and the inside faces of the boards were black and glossy from many years of making hams. From time to time the woman came to the back door to check his progress, and each time she said, "My girl's bowels was loose as stove ash for 2 weeks before she died." When Inman was done with the carpentry, he layered the bottom of the box with dry pine needles. He went into the house and got the girl, who lay on a downstairs bed cased in the quilt. He lifted her, and she was a hard, tight bundle, like a pod or gall. He carried her through the back door, and the mother sat at the kitchen table and looked at him out of blank eyes. He unwrapped the quilt and set the girl on the coffin lid and tried not to let his mind dwell on her pinched gray cheeks and keen nose. He cut the quilt with his knife and tacked it into the casket for lining, and then he lifted up the girl and settled her in the box and picked up the hammer and went to the door. "I'd better nail it too," he said. The woman came out and kissed the girl on each caved cheek and on her forehead. Then she sat on the porch edge and watched Inman hammer the lid tight. They buried her on a nearby knoll where lay four old graves marked with scratched flats of river shale. The first three were infants, birth dates lacking a month of being a year apart, death dates falling mere days after birth. The fourth grave was the mother, and Inman noted she had died on the birth date of the last child. He did quick sums in his head and saw that she lived only to 20. Inman dug the hole for the new grave at the end of the little row of stones, and when he was done he said, "Do you want to say something?" "No," the woman said. "Every word in me would come out bitter." By the time Inman refilled the hole, dark was coming on. He and the woman went back to the house. She said, "I ought to feed you, but I haven't got it in me to even light a fire, much less cook a meal." She went inside and came back with provisions, two little cloth bundles, one of corn grits and the other of flour, a chunk of lard tied in paper dark with grease, a brown piece of smoke-cured hog-neck bone, some parched corn, about a cup of soup beans twisted in a square of paper, a leek and a turnip and three carrots, a bar of lye soap. Inman took them and thanked the woman and turned to walk away, but before he reached the gate the woman called to him. "I can't ever look back on this day with a still mind if I let you go without cooking for you," she said. Inman kindled up a fire, and the woman sat on a low hearth stool and fried him a great beefsteak from a neighbor's heifer that had mired in a slough and died before anyone noticed it missing. The woman filled a brown crockery plate with yellow corn grits cooked thin so they ran to the edges, the steak cupped up in the frying like a hand held out for change, and she put it atop the grits with the cupped side down, and then mounted a pair of fried eggs atop the dome of meat. As final garnish, she scooped a plug of butter as big as a squirrel's head onto the eggs. When she set it on the table in front of Inman, he looked down on the plate and nearly cried as he watched the butter melt across the egg yolks and the whites and the brown meat and the yellow grits, until the whole plate glistered in the taper light. He sat with knife and fork fisted up before him, but he could not eat. The food seemed to require some special thanks to be returned, and he could not find the words. Outside in the dark, a bobwhite called, and waited for an answer, and then called again, and a small wind rose, and there was a momentary rain that rattled the leaves and the roof shakes, and then it stopped. "This meal needs blessing," Inman said. "Say one, then," the woman said. Inman thought a minute and said, "I can't call one up." "For what I am about to receive, I am thankful, that's one," she said. Inman said her words, trying them on for fit. Then he said, "You don't know how long it's been." As he ate, the woman took a picture from a shelf and studied it. "We had our likenesses made one time," she said. "Man traveling in a wagon with all his picture tackle. I'm the one survivor now." She wiped the dust from it on her sleeve and then reached out the little framed artifact for Inman to admire. Inman took it and tipped it to the candle, a daguerreotype. There was a father, the woman some years younger, an old granny, six children ranging from boys old enough to wear brimmed hats to bonneted babies. All the members wore black and sat with hunched shoulders, and all looked either suspicious or stunned, as if report of their deaths had just reached them. "I'm sorry," Inman said. When he was finished eating, the woman sent him on his way. He walked into the dark until new star patterns arose, and then he made a fireless bivouac alongside a thin creek. He tramped out a sleeping place in the tall dead grass and rolled up in his blanket and slept hard. Then, for several wet days following, he walked as long as he could and slept in the haunts of birds. One night he found lodging in a log pigeonier, and the birds ignored him except when he rolled over, and then they all stirred and made watery gurgling sounds and settled back in. The next night he slept on the dry square of ground under a steepled dovecot, a structure suggestive of a temple devoted to a tiny null god. He had to sleep balled up, for if he stretched out, either his feet or his head would catch the drip from the steep-hip roof. Another night he slept in an abandoned chicken house, and he spread his ground cloth over the floor, which was thick with chalky old chicken shit that gritted under him when he moved and smelled like the dusty remainders of ancient dead men. When he woke sometime long before dawn and could not get back to sleep, he dug in his pack and found a stub of candle and lit it. He unrolled the Bartram and held it to the yellow light and riffled through the pages until his eyes fell on a passage that caught his attention. It was this: "The mountainous wilderness which I had lately traversed appeared regularly undulated, as the great ocean after a tempest, the undulations gradually depressing, yet perfectly regular, as the squama of fish, or imbrications of tile on a roof, the nearest ground to me of a perfect full green, next more glaucous, and lastly almost blue, as the ether, with which the most distant curve of the horizon seemed to be blended. My imagination thus wholly engaged in the contemplation of this magnificent landscape, infinitely varied and without bound, I was almost insensible or regardless of the charming objects more within my reach." A picture of the land Bartram detailed leapt dimensional into Inman's mind. Mountains and valleys on and on forever. A gnarled and taloped and snaggy landscape where man might be seen as an afterthought. Inman had many times looked across the view Bartram described. It was the border country, stretching endlessly north and west from the slope of Cold Mountain. Inman knew it well. He had walked its contours in detail, had felt all its seasons, and registered its colors and smelled its smells. Bartram was only a traveler, and knew but the one season of his visit, and the weather that happened to fall in a matter of days. But to Inman's mind the land stood not as he'd seen it and known it for all his life, but as Bartram had summed it up. The peaks now stood higher, the vales deeper than they did in truth. Inman imagined the fading rows of ridges standing pale and tall as cloud banks, and he built the contours of them, and he colored them, each a shade paler and bluer, until when he had finally reached the invented ridge line, where it faded into the sky, he was asleep. The next day found Inman angling down to the southwest, foot-slogging an old cart path through the mountains. A brisk day, with all the leaves dead and on the ground. He was not even aware of what county he was in. Bloody Madison, perhaps. He came to a sign, and on one side it read TOBO55M, and on the other TOAV65M. All he could figure was that it would be a fair walk to whatever towns were meant. He rounded a bend and came to a small pool, a kind of spring, the rocks around it green with sphagnum. The spring bottom was covered with rotting oak and poplar leaves, and the water was amber, like a weak steeping of them, a tea. Inman bent to dip his canteen. Wind blew up, and he heard a strange talk and click, a sound like an attempt at music using only dry sticks as instruments. He looked off into the poolside woods toward the sound and discovered an odd sight. Inman found himself viewing a trio of hanging skeletons, swaying in the breeze and tapping into each other. The canteen glugged full. Inman stood and stoppered it and walked to the bones. They hung in a row from the lower limb of a big hemlock, not even hung with rope, just plaited strips of bark from hickory saplings. The pelvis and leg bones of one had fallen to the ground and lay in a heap, with the toes of one foot sticking up. On one of the complete skeletons, the plaits had stretched so much that the man's toes reached the ground. Inman swept the leaves away, thinking to find a tamped patch in the dirt where the man had danced around and packed the earth in his dying. His hair had fallen off the skull and lay among the leaves about his toe bones. Blonde. All the bones so white. Teeth in the slack jaws yellow. Inman ran his hand down the arm bones of the man that had half fallen away. They had a grain to them. The bones of legs and feet in a pile as kindling for a fire. He couldn't cut himself down, Inman thought, but if he'll be patient, it will happen. Some days later, Inman climbed all morning, not really knowing where he was. Mists moved ahead of him, like deer through the trees, and then for the afternoon he walked a ridgeline trail that rolled between balsam highlands and little gladed gaps where stood beech groves and the tail ends of cove hardwoods as they reached the highest places where they could live. As he walked, he began to suspect that he knew roughly where he was. It was an old passway, that much was clear. He passed a rock cairn that the Cherokee, in times long past, were in the habit of building along the way to signify something, though whether waymarker or memorial or holy place was now unknowable. Inman picked up a fresh rock and dropped it on the pile in passing as commemoration of some old upward yearning. Late in the day he found himself on a rocky scarp bordered by heath bald, a thick tangle of waist-high azalea and laurel and myrtle growing right to the bare rock of the ledge. The trail emptied onto it as if travelers had made a custom of stopping to admire the view. Then the way re-entered the forest through a faint passage in the azalea, not 40 feet from where he had emerged. The sun was falling, and Inman reckoned he would again make a bivouac without benefit of fire or water. In the space near the edge of the scarp, he scraped together what little duff there was to soften a sleeping place. He ate parched corn from his palm and stretched out in his bedding to sleep, wishing there were a bigger moon in the sky to light the prospect before him. He was awakened at first gray dawn by the sound of walking in the heath. He sat up and set the lamats on full cock and leveled it at the sound. In a minute, a black sowbear poked her head through the leaves not 20 feet from where Inman sat. She stood, tan muzzle up, neck stretched long, sniffing the breeze and blinking her little eyes. She did not like what she smelled. She shuffled forward and grunted. A single cub not much bigger than a man's head climbed a little way up the trunk of a young Fraser fir behind her. Inman knew that with her poor sight she could smell him but not see him in the faint light. She was, in fact, so near that even with his man's poor nose he could take her scent, wet dog, and something deeper. The bear twice whiffed out air from nose and mouth and moved forward tentatively. Inman shifted about and stood, and the bear pricked up her ears. She blinked and stretched her neck again and sniffed and moved another step forward. Inman set the pistol down on his bedding, for he had taken upon himself a vow to bear, never again to shoot one, though he had killed and eaten many in his youth, and knew that he still had in him a strong liking for the flavor of bear grease. The decision came as a result of a series of dreams he had over the period of a week in the muddy trenches of Petersburg. In the first of the dreams, he had started as a man. He was sick and drank tea from bearberry leaves as tonic, and gradually he became transformed into a black bear. During the nights the bear visions rode him, Inman roamed the green dream mountains alone and four-legged, avoiding all of his own kind and of other kinds. He rooted in the ground for pale grubs and tore at bee trees for honey and ate huckleberries by the bushful and was happy and strong. In that manner of life, he thought, there might be a lesson in how to wage peace and heal the wounds of war into white scars. In the final dream, though, he was shot by hunters after a long chase. He was strung from a tree by a rope about his neck and skinned, and he watched the process as from above. His dripping red carcass was, as he knew, an actual bear's to be after skinning, that is to say, man-like, thinner than one would expect, the structure of paws beneath the fur long like a man's hand. With that killing, the dreams had run their course, and he awoke that last morning, feeling bear was an animal of particular import to him, one he might observe and learn from, and that it would be on the order of a sin for him to kill one, no matter what the expense, for there was something in bear that spoke to him of hope. Still, he did not much favor his current position, backed up against the brow of the rocky ledge, the heath knotted up before him, and the sow nervous with a cub born out of season. In his favor was this: he knew a bear was much more likely to run than attack, that she might, at most, make a false charge, rushing forward 15 feet or so, bouncing as she came on her front legs and snorting out air. The purpose would be to scare him off, not to hurt him, but he had nowhere to run. He wanted her to know where he was, so he spoke to her, saying, "I've no aim to trouble you. I'll walk on from here and never be back. I'm just asking for clear passage." He spoke calm and straight, and he wanted his voice to carry respect. The bear sniffed more. She shifted from foot to foot, rocked from side to side. Inman slowly rolled up his bedding and slipped on his sacks. "I'll be going," he said. He moved 2 steps, and the bear false charged. Inman could figure in his mind, as it happened, that none of the measurements would work out. Like a problem of carpentry, where none of the dimensions match up. He had only 3 feet to back up. She had all the momentum of her bulk, and only 10 feet ahead of her before the lip of the cliff. Inman took a step to the side, and the bear rushed by him and plunged over the high ledge that she never saw in the gloom. He could smell her strong as she went by, wet dog, black dirt. He looked over and saw her break open on the rocks far below, like a great red blossom in the dawn light, black pelt scraps littering the rocks. "Shit," he thought, "even my best intentions come to naught, and hope itself is but an obstacle." The cub in the fur bawled out in its anguish. It was not even yet a weanling, and would wither and die without a mother. It would wail away for days until it starved or was eaten by wolf or panther. Inman walked to the tree and looked into the little bear's face. It blinked its black eyes at him and opened its mouth and cried like a human baby. To his credit, Inman could imagine reaching up and grabbing the cub by the scruff of its neck and saying, "We're kin," then taking his knapsack off and thrusting the cub in with only its head sticking out, then putting the pack back on and walking away, the bear looking about from this new perspective as bright-eyed as a papoose. Give it to Ada as a pet, or if she turned him away, he might raise it to be a part-tame bear, and when full-grown it might stop by his hermit cabin on Cold Mountain now and again for company. Bring its wife and children, so that in years to come Inman could have an animal family, if no other. That would be one way this dead bear calamity might be rectified. What Inman did, though, was all he could do. He picked up the Lamats and shot the cub in the head, and watched it pause as its grip on the tree failed and it fell to ground. So as not to waste the meat, Inman built a fire and skinned out the cub and cut it in pieces and parboiled it. He laid the black pelt out on a rock, and it was no bigger than a coon's. While the bear cooked, he sat and waited at the scarp as morning came on. The mists broke, and he could see mountains and rivers rank to the earth's far verge. Shadows slid down the slopes of the nearest line of ridges, falling into the valley as if draining into a vast pool of dark under the ground. Rags of cloud hung in the valleys below Inman's feet, but in all that vista there was not a rooftop or plume of smoke or cleared field to mark a place where man had settled. You could look out across that folded landscape, and every sense you had told only that this was all the world there was. The wind sweeping up the mountain carried away the smell of the bear boiling and left only the odor of wet stone. Inman could see west for scores of miles, crest and scarp and crag stacked and gray to the long horizon. Cataloochee, the Cherokee word was, meaning waves of mountains in fading rows, and this day the waves could hardly be differed from the raw winter sky. Both were barred and marbled with the same shades of gray only, so the outlook stretched high and low like a great slab of streaked meat. Inman himself could not have been better dressed to conceal himself amid this world, for all he wore was gray and black and dirty white. Bleak as the scene was, though, there was growing joy in Inman's heart. He was nearing home. He could feel it, in the touch of thin air on skin, in his longing to see the leap of hearth smoke from the houses of people he had known all his life, people he would not be called upon to hate or fear. He rose and took a wide stance on the rock and stood and pinched down his eyes to sharpen the view across the vast prospect to one far mountain. It stood apart from the sky only as the stroke of a poorly inked pen, a line thin and quick and gestural, but the shape slowly grew plain and unmistakable. It was to Cold Mountain he looked. He had achieved a vista of what, for him, was homeland. As he studied on it, he recognized the line of every far ridge and valley to be more than remembered. They seemed long ago scribed indelible on his corneas with a sharp instrument. He looked out at this highland and knew the names of places and things. He said them aloud. Little Beartail Ridge, Wagon Road Gap, Ripshin, Hunger Creek, Clawhammer Knob, Rocky Face. Not a mountain or watercourse lacked denomination, not bird or bush anonymous, his place. He rocked his head from side to side, and it felt balanced anew on his neck stem. He entertained the notion that he stood unfamiliarly plumb to the horizon. For a moment it seemed thinkable that he might not always feel cored out. Surely, off in that knotty country, there was room for a man to vanish. He could walk, and the wind would blow the yellow leaves across his footsteps, and he would be hid and safe from the wolfish gaze of the world at large. Inman sat and admired his country until the bare pieces were cooked, and then he dredged them in flour and fried them up in the last lard from the twisted paper the woman had given him days before. He ate sitting at the cliff top. He had not eaten bear of such youth before, and though the meat was less black and greasy than that of older bear, it still tasted, nevertheless, like sin. He tried to name which of the deadly seven might apply, and when he failed, he decided to append an eighth, regret. Knot and Grief. If the lobe of mountain they climbed had a name, Stavrod did not know it. He and his two companions walked humped up, their downturned faces clenched against the cold, hat brims raked near to their noses, hands pulled up into coat sleeves. Their shadows blew out long before them, so that they trod on their resemblances. The woods passed unremarked around them. Bare sticks of buckeye, silverbell, tulip tree, and basswood waved in the breeze. Many wet millennia of leaves underfoot muted their steps. The Pangle Boy trod close upon Stavrod's heels. The third figure followed 6 paces back. Stavrod carried his fiddle in its sack clamped under his arm, and Pangle had his banjo thonged neck down over his shoulder. The third man had no music device, but toted all the party's meager goods in a knapsack. He had enshrouded himself in a moth-riddled butternut blanket that trailed on the ground, dragging a wake in the leaves. Their bowels were all a clamor from the previous night's supper, which they'd made from a doe they'd found dead on the ground, frozen to it. In their meat hunger, they'd chosen to ignore signs of how long the thing had been there or how it might have died. They'd built a smoky little fire of wet poplar and cooked up its haunch until it was not much more than thawed out. They ate it in some quantity, and now they regretted it. They did not talk. Now and again, one of them flared off into a laurel thicket and caught back up later. No wind hissed nor bird called, the only sound fine needles falling when they passed beneath stands of hemlock. Vestiges of dawn yet fanned out ochre in the east, and thin clouds scudded fast across the brittle sun. The twined dark limbs of hardwoods stood etched against the weak light. For some time there was no color to anything earthly other than somber tones of brown and gray. Then they passed an icy rock ledge, and saw growing on it some flabby yellow sect of wart or lichen, so bright it hurt the eyes. Pangle reached out and broke off a scalloped leathern flap, and ate it speculatively and with great attentiveness. He neither spit it out nor pulled off more, so his judgment on the taste was hard to call. Afterward, though, he walked along bright in his perceptions, alert for other such gifts the world might give. In time they ascended to a piece of flat ground where 3 pathways came together, the one they had arrived by falling, two yet fainter climbing on. The greater of the forks had begun life as a buffalo trail, and then an Indian path, and it remained still too tight in its passage between trees to make even a wagon road. Hunters had camped here and left a well-used fire ring, and had cut trees for firewood, and the woods were thin some 50 paces back from where the ways wide off. An immense poplar, though, stood in the forks of the rising tracks. It had not been spared cutting out of any homage to its beauty or its girth or its age. There was just not a cross-cut saw in any near settlement long enough to span it. Its trunk was big around as a corn crib where it entered the ground. Stavrod, thinking he dimly remembered the place, stopped to survey it, and when he did, Pangle trod on his boot heel. Stavrod's foot came out entire, and he stood sock-footed on frozen leaf mold. He turned and put a hard finger to the boy's breastbone and pushed him a step away, and then stooped and put his fiddle-sack on the ground and reshod himself. The men stood together, blowing from the climb and looking at the two paths ahead of them. Their breaths hovered about them as if in concern, and then the vague shapes lost interest and vanished. There was a creek tumbling somewhere nearby within earshot, and it provided all the sound there was to the place. "It's cold," the third man said. Stavrod looked at him, and then cleared his throat and spit, in commentary on the bleakness of the scene and the depthlessness of the observation. Pangle reached a hand out of his sleeve and turned it palm up to the elements, and then fisted it and drew it back in as a turtle its head. "I got shrivel your cullions up in your belly," he said. "What I mean," the third man said. They had acquired the man at the outlier's cave. He had not offered a name, nor did Stavrod care to know it. He was a Georgia boy of no more than 17 years, black-headed, brown-skinned, little fine wisps of chin whiskers, but smooth-cheeked as a maid, some Cherokee blood, or maybe Creek. Like everybody else, he had a war tale. He and his cousin had been pitiful little conscriptees, and they'd been put into the troops in 63. They had fought out a year of war in the same regiment, though there was not much they could contribute, since their rifle muskets stood higher than their hat crowns. They'd slept every night under the same blanket, and they had deserted together. Their reasoning was that no war lasts forever, and though man was born to die, it would be foolish to do so on the eve of peace, so they left. But the walk home was long and confusing, and they had not reckoned on quite so much landscape passing under their feet. It had taken them 3 months to reach Cold Mountain, and they did not even know what state it was in. They'd become profoundly lost, and the cousin had died in a grim cove, feverish and racked with coughs from some wet lung disorder. The boy had been found by one of the cavers some day later, wandering aimless. He had been given over to Stavrod and Pangle, who were setting off to found their own community of two, somewhere up near the Shining Rocks. Even though Georgia was a state Stavrod held in low regard, he had agreed to point it out to the boy when they reached a height where they had a great southern vista. First, however, they had descended from the cave to a hiding place for food, telling the boy along the way about Ada and how she had eventually led Ruby toward benevolence. Ruby had laid down conditions for her charity, though. She and Ada were themselves working on tight margins for the winter and could give only a little, not enough for the two men to live on entirely. And she thought it risky for Stavrod and Pangle to visit. She did not want to see so much as their shadows about the farm again. The food would have to be left somewhere safe and hidden, and she had suggested a place up along the ridge that she had discovered in her rambles as a child, a round flat stone marked from rim to rim with all manner of odd scripture. And further, she did not want to be tied down to any schedule. She'd take food there when she felt like it, and not take it when she didn't. It was up to Stavrod to check. When the men had gotten to the place, Stavrod cast his eyes about and then knelt and felt around with his hands under the leaves. Then he started raking with the edge of his boot, and soon he had uncovered a round, flat stone set in the ground. It was about the size of the mouth of a washtub, and the markings showed not any feature of the Cherokee style. They were too abrupt and strict in the angles of their characters, which jittered across the stone as a spider on a skillet. It might have come from some race prior to man. Under the edge of the rock they found a 10 box of cornmeal, some dried apples twisted up in a piece of paper, a few shavings of side meat, an earthen crock of pickled beans. These they had added to their own provisions of liquor and smoking tobacco and chewing tobacco. "Reckon which trail we want," the Georgia boy now said to Stavrod. The blanket bumped out where his elbow gestured toward the trail forks and made folds to the ground like drapery in carved stone. Stavrod looked as directed, but he was not at all sure where they were nor which way they were going. He just knew higher, more remote. It was a big mountain. Walk a circuit around what might rightly be called the base of it, and you'd walk not far short of 100 miles. There's a right smarter range encompassed therein, even if it were flat as a plat map rather than reared up in the sky and folded into every kind of cove and hollow and vale. As well, Stavrod's previous experience of Cold Mountain had been, whenever possible, as a drunk. So in his mind the trails tangled together and could lead anywhither. Pangle watched Stavrod's confused study of the landscape, and then finally, with a halting preamble of apology for knowing more than his mentor, he said he knew exactly where he was, and knew that the right-hand fork soon grew faint, but worked its way on and on across the mountain, leading farther than he had ever cared to follow, going wherever it was the Indians went. The left fork was broader at first, but just wandered around and petered out shortly near a dank pool of water. "We'll cook us a meal and head on then," Stavrod said. The men drew together wood and struck a reluctant blaze in the old black ring of stones. They put some cornmeal mush to boiling in creek water, supposing that its blandness might settle their moiled stomachs. They pulled up sitting logs and lit clay pipes and puffed and crowded as near to the faint flames as they could without setting their clothes and their boot soles afire. They passed the liquor bottle and took long swigs. The keen weather had seeped into their bones and gelled their marrow hard as cold lard. They sat quiet, waiting for the warmth of fire and liquor to loosen them up. After a time, Stavrod became deeply engaged in probing his knife blade into the crock of pickled beans he held before him. He nibbled one bean at a time from the end of the knife, and between each one wiped the vinegar off the blade against his pant leg. Pangle ate a little withered ring of dried apple, first rubbing it out flat between his palms and holding it up to his eye as if its core hole served as spyglass to give new perspective on the things of the world. The Georgia boy sat humped forward, hands to the fire. His blanket was cowled over his head, and it left his visage all shadowed but for the firelight striking off his black eyes. He put a hand to his belly and stiffened up, as if someone had run a pointed stick through his vitals. "If I'd known I'd have the scours this bad, I'd not have eaten one mouthful of that venison," he said. He stood and walked slowly and with some delicacy off into the rhododendron thicket beyond the clearing. Stavrod watched him go. "I feel sorry for that boy," he said. "He's wishing he'd never left home, but he's not even got sense to know what kind of vile state he's from. If I had a brother in jail and one in Georgia, I'd try to bust the one out of Georgia first." "I've never been so far as Georgia," Pangle said. "I went just the one time," Stavrod said, "not but a little piece into it, just until I could see what poor stuff it was made of, and then I turned back." The fire flared up from a puff of wind, and the men put their hands out to warm. Stavrod dozed off, his head nodded until his chin was at his chest. When it jerked back up, he was looking at mounted men in the trail, just cresting the brow of the hill. A little bunch of sorry-looking scouts led by a dandy man and a slight boy. But the men had sabers and pistols and rifles, several of which were pointed at Stavrod. The guard rode bundled in heavy coats and wrapped in blankets, and the horses steamed in the cold air and puffed out plumes from their pooched nostrils. There was a skin of ice in the roadway, and when they stepped forward their hooves gritted in it like pestle against mortar. The guard came on up the trail and into the clearing until they loomed over the men and threw their shadows on them. Stavrod made to rise, and Teek said, "Sit still." He sat loose in the saddle, and he held a short-barreled Spencer carbine, with the incurved butt plate of it fit against the swell of his thigh. He had on wool gloves, the thumb and forefinger cut off the right hand so he could pull back a hammer and trip a trigger unhindered. Plaited reins held finely between the covered finger and thumb of his other hand. He studied the pair of men before him for some time. Their skin was gray, and their eyes looked raw as holes burnt in a quilt top. The fat boy's hair stood in greasy brown peaks like meringue on one side of his head and lay matted to the skull on the other. The skin of Stavrod's balding pate was grainy and dull, slack-looking over the bone, altogether lacking in the taut sheen common to the hairless. His face looked to have collapsed all around the point of his nose so that he resembled a funnel. Teague said, I'm not even going to ask if you've got papers. I've heard every falsehood there is to tell in that regard. We're after a bunch of outliers said to live in a cave. They've been robbing folks. If a man knew where that cave bores into the mountain, it might be in his favor to tell it. I don't exactly know, Stavrod said. His voice was real quick and bright, though inside he was gloomy, figuring that within a month he would be back in bloody Virginia, working a ramrod into a musket. I'd say if I did, he said. I've just heard talk of such a thing. Some say it's way over on the back side of the mountain, close on Bear Pin Branch or Shining Creek or some like place. Pangle looked funny at Stavrod, puzzlement dark on his face as a shadow. What's your word on this? Teak said to Pangle. The boy sat with his torso canted back, his weight settled on the platform of his wide hip bones. A hand shaded his eyes from the hazed sun that stood behind the shoulders of the horseman grouped before him. He peered from his little-sized eyes in some confusion. He wondered how best to answer the question that had been put to him, all manner of thoughts crossing his soft face. "Why, that's not even close to it," Pangle finally said, looking to Stavrod. "It's this side, you know, over on Big Stomp, not 3 mile up Nick Creek. You get where it turkey foots out and there's a stand of hickory trees growing up on the right-hand slope. A sight of squirrels works the ground under them in the fall, squirrels thick on the ground. You can kill them with rocks. You climb straight up a ways through them hickories to a rock fall, and then at the top of it, there you are. There's a hollow in the cliff there big as a great barn loft." "Much obliged," Teak said. He turned to two big dark horsemen and twisted up a slight shade of meaning with one corner of his mouth. He put his weight in his stirrups, and his leathers squeaked, and he swung a leg over and dismounted. The other men followed. "We'll join you at your fire if you don't mind," Teak said to Stavrod. "Take some breakfast with you, cook and eat, and then in a little bit we'll hear you boys pick some, see if you're any account." They built up the fire and sat around it as if they were all fellow men. The guard had a great quantity of sausage tied up in casings, and when they pulled it out of their saddlebags it was frozen hard and coiled like the bowels of something. They had to cut it in cooking pieces with a little hand axe. They put the cut pieces on flat stones at the edge of the fire to thaw enough to run sharpened sticks through them and hold them out to roast. The fire was soon tall flame and red coal and a bed of white ash, and it threw enough heat that Pangle unbuttoned his jacket and then his shirt and put out a strip of his pale chest and belly to it and became all at ease. He had no sense that there was anything to the moment but warmth and comradeship and the smell of food cooking. He studied his banjo a minute, seeming to admire its form and the rightness of its materials as if he had never seen it before, as though he liked studying its geometry nearly as much as he did playing it. Soon his eyes fogged over and closed, and he sat slumped, all the weight of him collapsed through his trunk onto the broad base of his ass, so that the front of him was a cascade of white flesh rolls. He was a sculpture carved in the medium of lard. "Gone from the world," Stavrod said, "wore out." Teague took a bottle of liquor from his coat pocket and held it out to Stavrod. "Not too early for you, is it?" he said. "I commenced some time ago," Stavrod said. "When you've not slept but a snatch or two in days, it's hard to say what's too early." He took the offered bottle and drew the cork and tipped it to his mouth, and though it was only of mediocre quality, he was polite in his estimation of it. He smacked his lips and blew out his breath and nodded at the taste. "Why have you not slept?" Teague said. Stavrod explained that they had been picking music and gambling for a few days and nights with some sharps, though he neglected to say that it had been at the Outlier's Cave. Cards, chicken fights, dog fights, dice, any contest they could think up to lay bets on. Big gamblers, hot to wager. Some in such a fever they would win the hat off your head and then odd man for your hair. Lacking anything more striking, they'd put money on which of a gathering of birds would fly off a limb first. Stavrod bragged that he had broken even, which in such company was a thing to marvel at. Teague put the knuckles of his fingers together and made a motion like thumbing cards off a deck. "Sportsman," he said. The sausages swelled, oozed fat, squealed faintly in their casings, made spitting sounds when they dripped in the coals. Eventually they were brown. All the men but Pangle, who yet slept, ate them off the points of the cooking sticks, and when they had eaten until the meat was gone, Teague looked at the fiddle and banjo and said, "Can you play those things?" "Some," Stavrod said. "Pick me something then," Teague said. Stavrod did not much want to. He was tired, and he figured his audience had no thought of music. lacked entirely what was needed to love it. But he took up his fiddle anyway and just brushed the dry skin of his palm across the strings and knew from their whisper what keys to twist. "What do you want to hear?" he said. "No matter. You call it," Teague said. Stavrod reached over and prodded Pangle in the shoulder. The boy came too, his little eyes just slitted. With evident effort, he pulled his thoughts together so that they trained up to some purpose. "They want to hear us pick a tune," Stavrod said. Pangle said nothing, but worked his finger joints a while in the heat of the fire. He picked up his banjo and twiddled with the pegs, and then, without waiting for Stavrod, began knocking out a few notes to backstep Cindy. As he picked, the rolled fat of his front jiggled in time with the frailing, but when he got to where the tune was ready to come around again, the notes scrambled all together, and he bogged down and halted. "That'un's come to naught and grief," he said to Stavrod. "If you was to pitch in, we might get somewhere." Stavrod bowed a note or two from Cindy, and then some other notes, seeming at random, unrelated. He went over them and over them, and it began to be clear that they made no sense. But he suddenly gathered them up and worked a variation on them, and then another yet more precise, and they unexpectedly fell together into a tune. He found the pattern he was seeking, and he followed the trail of notes where they led, finding the way of their logic, which was brisk, brittle, effortless as laughing. He played the run of it a time or two until Pangle had his chord changes down and had spun off a series of quick answering notes, bright and harsh. Then they set off together to see what sort of thing they had composed. Though in form it was neither jig nor reel, it was yet right for dancing. Their stomachs, however, were still in such a rage that neither of them could have shuffled out a step. Pangle nevertheless had one foot patting ground on the offbeat, and his head was nodding, and his eyes were loose closed, so that there was but a trembling rim of white showing between the lashes. Stavrod played a run of notes and then lowered the fiddle from under his bristled neck, so that the butt of it rested against his chest. He beat out the rhythm on the strings with his bow. Pangle caught on and did the same with his flattened hand against the groundhog hide of the banjo head, and momentarily there was a sense that the instruments they played were just elaborations on the drum. To the thumping, Stavrod put back his head and sang out a lyric he was making up at the moment. It had to do with women whose bellies were hard as the necks of mules. Such women, the song proclaimed, were cruel beyond the generality of their sex. When he was done singing, they played one more round and then stopped. They consulted and twisted the pegs again to make the dead man's tuning, and then they set in playing a piece slightly reminiscent of Bonaparte's Retreat, which some named General Washington's tune. This was softer, more meditative, yet nevertheless grim as death. When the minor key drifted in, it was like shadows under trees, and the piece called up something of dark woods, lantern light. It was awful old music in one of the ancient modalities, music that sums up a culture and is the true expression of its inner life. Birch said, "Jesus wept, the fits took them now." None of the guard had ever heard fiddle and banjo played together in that tuning. Nor had they heard playing of such strength and rhythm applied to musical themes so direful and elegiac. Pangle's use of the thumb on the fifth string and dropping to the second was an especial thing of arrogant wonder. It was like ringing a dinner bell, yet solemn. His other two fingers worked in a mere hard groping style, but one honed to brutish perfection. Stavrod's fingers on the fiddle neck found patterns that seemed set firm as the laws of nature. There was a deliberation, a study to their clamping of the strings that was wholly absent from the reckless bowing of the right hand. What lyric Stavrod sang recounted a dream, his or some fictive speaker's, said to have been dreamed on a bed of hemlocks, and containing a rich vision of lost love, the passage of awful time, a girl wearing a mantle of green. The words, without music, would have seemed hardly fuller in detail than a telegraphic message, but together they made a complete world. When the song fell closed, Birch said to Teague, "Good God, these is holy men. Their mind turns on matters kept secret from the likes of you and me." Teague sucked on a tooth and looked off in the distance, as if trying to remember something. He stood and squared his coat lapels and twisted at his pant waist until he had his breeches adjusted to his satisfaction. He took his Spencer's from the ground and brought the muzzle of it to bear on the space between Stavrod and Pangle. He had the forestock of it resting across the back of his left wrist, and the hand drooped down calm. "Stand up against that big poplar," he said, looking at Stavrod, "and take that boy with you." For lack of a better idea, Stavrod went and stood at the tree. It rose near 100 feet, straight and clear and monolithic above him, before there was a limb. Even then there were but two, the size of regular trees themselves, rising in curves like the arms of a candelabra. The crown of the tree had broken off some time in the previous century, and the mossy stout cylinder of it lay remnant on the ground nearby, slowly melting into the dirt, so soft with rot that you could have kicked it apart like an old dung pile and watched the histor beetles scuttle away. Stavrod held the fiddle before him in the crook of his arm. The bow hung from a finger and twitched slightly in time with his heartbeat. Pangle stood beside him, and theirs was the proud and nervous pose men struck when having ambrotypes made at the start of the war, though instead of rifle musket and Colt pistol and bowie knife, Stavrod and Pangle held fiddle and banjo before them as defining implements. Pangle put his free arm around Stavrod's shoulders, as schoolboy companions once did. The guard raised their rifles, and Pangle grinned at them. There was not a bit of irony or bravado in the smile, it was merely friendly. "I can't shoot a man grinning at me," one of the men said, half lowering his rifle. "Quit grinning," Teague said to Pangle. Pangle twisted his mouth up and worked to straighten it, but then it twitched and went back into a grin. "There is nothing funny here," Teague said, "not a thing. Compose yourself to die." Pangle wiped both hands down his face from hairline to chin. He pulled down the corners of his mouth with his pair of thumbs, and when he let them go they sprung back up on him, so that his face broke open and smiled like a blossom. "Take your hat off," Teague said. Pangle took his hat off, and, still grinning, held it two-handed, at waist level, by the brim. He turned it around and around, as if in demonstration of how the world turns. "Hold it over your face," Teague said. Pangle raised the hat and put it over his face, and when he did, the guard tripped the triggers, and wood chips flew from the great poplar tree where balls struck after passing through the meat of the two men. Black Bark in Winter. And when they finished up jerking their trigger fingers, the horses all jumped and spooked, and the head man went to cussing them and took his hat off and went and slapped them all in their faces with it. They didn't cover them or even go stand over them to say words, except that one of them said that what had passed might fairly be called a shootout since shots had been fired. Then one of them laughed, and one of them went and made water in the fire, and they mounted up and rode off. I don't know what kind of place this is that I'm in, where people do one another that way. The Georgia boy's bearing was of a man in the near aftermath of fright. He was yet excited, and there was urgency in his desire to express a tale he believed to be thrilling, yet truthful. "I seen it all done," he said, "seen it all." "Then why were you not killed or taken, if you were close enough to witness?" Ada said. The boy thought about it. He looked off to the side, and he raked his hair off his brow with splayed fingers, and then flipped at the gate latch with his thumb. He stood on the roadside of the yard fence, Ada and Ruby on the other side. They talked over the gate palings, and they could smell the wood smoke in his damp, sweated clothes, his wet, unwashed hair. "Heard it done anyways," he answered. "Heard what I didn't see would be more as it was. I'd stepped into the woods, back a piece into the laurels. Of a necessity, like." "Yes," Ada said. "For the privacy, so to say." "We took your meaning," Ruby said. "What's the upshot of all this?" "It's what I'm trying to tell you. That I left them a-layin' there bloody and dead in a heap under a big poplar, and then I run all the way here. I remembered where the fiddler said you lived. I went to that picture rock where we stopped yesterday for food, and I run down from there till I found the house." "How long?" Ruby said. The boy looked around and examined the flat gray clouds and the blue ridge lines, as if trying to get his bearings. But he could not call in which quarter west lay, nor did the sky give much assistance in saying what the hour might be, for it held no bright spots, only the few colors of an old axe head. "It's 3, Ada informed him, 2:30 at the earliest. 3, the boy said, as if mildly surprised. He looked down and examined the beaten ground at the threshold to the yard. He pressed his lips together and worked his mouth. He was counting back. He reached up and gripped two of the palings in his fists. He blew out air between his lips in a way as not quite to make a whistle. 7 hours, he finally said. 6 or 7, I'd say. And you running all the way, Ruby said. Some of it, running, he said. I was scared, it's hard to recollect, but I run till I give out. Then I run some and walk some, first one, then the other. "We'll need you to guide us back there," Ada said. But the boy did not wish to go back up on the mountain, and Wood, he claimed, rather be shot where he stood than visit it again. He'd seen all of it he cared to see. Every companion he'd had there was now dead in its woods. He wanted to be home, was his only desire. And by his way of keeping tally, the news he had brought ought of its own to be worth some food, and another blanket, and a thing or two else he might need on the journey. Many another man would have left the two lie where they fell and not care that the wolves would soon strip them to bone, he said. And he told the women he reckoned wolves had already gotten to his dead cousin. Without digging implements, the best he had been able to do by way of burial was to set the body under the lip of a little waterfall in the creek. There had been a dry place there, beneath an undercut ledge where the water spilled over and made a curtain, so it was like a chamber between earth and water. He told how he set his cousin up cross-legged against a rock and said some words over the still face to the effect that there was this world and one more, and in that next one they might meet again. He said he walked away, and then he looked back, and the sun was shining through the mist of the waterfall and striking rainbows out of it. So, no, he had no intention of setting foot back on that mountain. "Cold Mountain stands right in the way of where you want to be," Ruby said, "but do as you please. We've got no need for you. I know about where you're talking of, and we can lead the horse and not lack much of making it in 5 hours, walking every step of the way. We'll feed you, though. It's not like we've not been feeding every other stray that wanders through." Ruby opened the gate and let the boy into the yard. He went and sat on the front steps between the big boxwoods and rubbed his hands together and breathed on them. Ruby stayed at the gate. She reached up and rested a hand on a bare, twisted bough of the crabapple tree and stood looking out into the road. Ada stepped to her side and looked at the side of her face. In Ada's experience, what women did at such times of loss was to weep and embrace each other and speak words of comfort and faith, and though she did not entirely trust those formulas any more, she was ready to offer any of them to Ruby that might do her good. Ada did, in fact, reach out and touch the dark hair gathered up and bound with a hide strip at Ruby's neck. Ruby, though, seemed not to welcome even that small comfort. She twisted her head away. She was not crying or balling up her apron hem in her hands, or in any other visible way fretting over the news of Stobrod's death. She just rested her hand on the crabapple limb and looked out into the road. She expressed but one concern aloud. Were they burying the men on the mountain, or bringing them back to Black Cove and resting them in the little graveyard among the blacks? There were reasons for and against either way. But since Stobrod and the blacks had not cared for each other in life, she thought it all in all better to keep them separate in death. "We need to know now, for it comes to a matter of what we pack," Ruby said, "shovels and the like." Ada was somewhat confused about not bringing the men back. It sounded so informal, like burying a dog. "We cannot just go up there and dig a hole and put them in it and come home," she said. "How would that differ from what we'd do if we hauled them down here?" Ruby said. "It was me, I'd about rather rest on the mountain than anywhere else you could name." Put that way, Ada could find no argument. She needed to go into the house to make dinner for the boy, but before she did, she reached out and hugged Ruby for her own comfort, if nothing else. Ada realized it was the first time they'd embraced, and Ruby stood with her arms to her sides and was just a hard knot of a person in Ada's arms. In the kitchen, Ada made a plate of cold leftovers from their dinner, fried apples, cornbread, some dried lima beans that had cooked over long to mush. The beans had congealed in the pot as they cooled, and had a color and consistency that reminded her of pâté, and so on a whim she unmolded the beans from the pot and cut two slices. When she went outside and handed the boy the plate, he studied the beans for some time. The look on his face said he believed he had found yet more evidence of the kind of place he was in. "That's beans," Ada said. The boy looked at them again and then forked off a tiny bite to test her word. "We don't eat them that away at all where I'm from," he said. While the boy sat on the steps and ate, Ruby sat a step above him and talked him out a map of the long way around Cold Mountain. Ada sat in a porch rocker and watched them, two short, dark people of such resemblance they might be taken for brother and sister. Ruby told the boy how to stick to the high ridges and avoid the main ways along creek valleys where people would be, described all the landmarks he would need to make his way up Cold Spring Knob, then to Double Spring Gap, and on to Bear Pen Gap, Horsebone Gap, Beach Gap. From there, head downhill, and at any fork of trail or creek, bear to the southwest. By such route, the boy's flat and sorry home lay no more than 2 weeks distant. Go by dark and